You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Opera News. My name is Keith. The following articles are from the March 2024 Opera with Opera News magazine, and we'll begin by continuing Finding the Passion. Most of what I did with the two arias was simply necessity for me. My voice is a high voice. I do have a lot of middle and low, but I prefer to sing high. My teacher was also very good in instructing me about support and about line. Later, I had a lot of coaching in New York, but the most extensive coaching I did for Donna Anna, in terms of drama and color, was with Muti at La Scala. R.P. Thinking about the events of the opera itself, first of all, there is that much-discussed question, what happens before the curtain rises? C.V. Every director wants you to view it differently. It's never just one thing. But if it's going to be true to the beauty of Mozart, for me the logical thing is something Peter Hall did at Glyndebourne. Anna is in an arranged betrothal with Don Ottavio. He's an older man and a lawyer. Think about everything Don Ottavio says. He does talk like a lawyer. Peter believed that Anna wanted to get to know Ottavio a little, so for the first time in her life, she took a chance. She wrote him a note, saying something like, I'd like to receive you in my chambers. The Don sees him arriving there and says, This is where that beautiful woman lives. What's going on here? Aha! I can just go in disguise to see her, and won't that be interesting? So later on in Act One, there is a reason for Anna to say to Ottavio, When he came in, I thought it was you. She'd been immediately shocked to find out it was the Don, not Ottavio. And why isn't Ottavio shocked when she says that to him? He doesn't say, What do you mean? You sent me a note. What happened? In any case, you can forgive her that she made a mistake. Donna Anna has horrible trauma, and you can forgive her for anything after seeing her father lying dead on the floor. R.P. And Ottavio is again with you when you encounter Giovanni and Elvira. C.V. In that scene, she's in the heat of her grief. She and Ottavio are either going to or coming from the cemetery. In any case, there's so much pain for her, she's in such terrible shape, and there's only so much that she can show publicly. R.P. Actually, Ottavio is there in all of Anna's scenes. Did you ever have a tenor who really asserted himself in Ottavio's relationship with Anna? C.V. Ghost of Inberg, who was a good-looking guy and played the role with athleticism. He did pull back in Dalla Sua Pace, but he had incredible directed passion. And if he was going to touch you, he didn't hesitate to really get a hold of you. I also loved singing Donna Anna with Jerry Hadley, who had moments like that. He was, I think, a wonderful but more emotional Don Ottavio. So when he said, I'm hurting for her, you could actually see that hurt. R.P. In the whole narrative that comes before Or Sai Chi L'Onore, should we believe her or not? C.V. You should believe it as much as she believes it. I've had directors ask me to play it as if she's just a big liar. I don't think that's satisfying, because her music, everywhere, is just so beautiful. When she starts the recit, Don Ottavio son morta, she's freaking out. Her father was murdered, and that's enough to ruin her life. I think she has gigantic guilt and blames herself. At this moment, she may be embellishing a bit to get Ottavio to take action. There are some directors who think she really enjoyed sex with the Don. In the Met production, I added a trace of that. At Da Lui Mi Skiloski, I freed myself of him. I felt a little bit of a frisson, an electricity. She's such a complicated character, and for me she was always more interesting than Donna Elvira, although I love Elvira too. Donna Anna just seemed a bigger challenge dramatically, and I was always ambitious about wanting to grow as an actress. That's what has drawn me to most of the characters I've played. RP. For most Dona Annas, or Saichi Lunari is usually such a stretch, but it was never for you. What do you think is most important in getting through it comfortably? CV. The key is to look at the musical markings, including the approaches to the high A's. It's marked every now and then piano or pianissimo. I don't think Mozart means it to be super soft, but I just wanted to keep that idea in my head. I tried to make it more gentle. When you first start work on Orsai, it feels like the most unsatisfying thing in the world. To be a great interpreter of that aria is to not have fun. Dona Anna is a C to F roll at the top of the stave, and that's where you have to remain. You can't come down ever. And you have to stay careful, careful, careful. RP. The next time we see Anna, she's got the masked trio to sing with Elvira and Ottavio. You had so much more voice to work with than a lot of your partners. Was it sometimes tough to pull back and balance with them in this music? CV. It can be tricky. In the opening line, Proteggia il giusto cielo, with the vowel on that first F, in the singer's vocal placement, you have to say to yourself, don't move, don't move. Like a gymnast, I would make a landing and not make a move from that landing. You know, the way I taught myself initially was that I didn't want a lot of extra movement because I wanted to look pretty when I sang. That's 1,000% true. RP. Later, in the recitativo accompagnato before Non mi dir, she's saying, ma il mondo, oh Dio. In other words, what would people say if I married you now? It doesn't make her especially sympathetic at that moment. How do you feel about her attitude? CV. I've never actually thought about that particular moment before. Looking at it now, for me it has to do with the formality of death in a Catholic family in Spain. You want me to get married to you right now? My father's blood is still on the floor. RP. The aria's legato section is so exposed. Did you actually enjoy it? CV. Yes, I always did. I had many church jobs, temple jobs, all kinds of singing jobs. So one thing I became good at was straight tone. It helped me to keep my voice in line. I'm talking about the onset for it. And once you have that, the first phrase begins on F, which is kind of a mixed note. You can put it in lower voice or head voice, but certainly the G of that phrase has to be in head voice, because otherwise it doesn't stay in tune. RP. You've proven with Anna, Elvira, Vitellia, and Fiore di Lisci that a Verdi-sized soprano can certainly sing clean Mozart coloratura. So why do so many singers struggle with the second half of Non mi dir? CV. They don't practice enough. In the second half of that aria, you have to be like a crazy person. You have no idea how many years I spent going, she sings the most important melodic pattern of the aria's coloratura section. How many times does a gymnast get on that bar and miss? To get the routine perfectly, you have to practice and practice for every eventuality. It's only about 10 or 11 bars, but they can make or break your performance. People complain, she was good in the role, but her coloratura wasn't great. Wherever I sang Dona Anna, I didn't want them to think about the coloratura. I wanted them to think about the beauty of the music of that aria and how it reveals her heart. RP. What do you think is the key to creating an effective Mozart ensemble? CV. When they really work, Mozart ensembles are, on the whole, very smart. And there's no big giant diva in a Mozart opera, or divo, either. The working together is as important as your arias. Think of E nel tuo, nel mio bicchiere. She sings the exquisite opening of the Così fan tutte banquet scene quartet. To sing that beautifully, each person has to bring their own thing to it, but with the idea that when the next person comes in, you don't sing louder than they do, you support them. It was always a great honor to sing Dona Anna with the greatest casts and the great conductors. I was so blessed. Can you believe that I actually sang Don Giovanni with Cesare Siepi and Giuseppe Taddei in San Francisco? They had class, beautiful class. Noble singing, noble interaction, just noble. RP. I remember a comment that the Canadian mezzo-soprano Judith Forrest once made to me during Così fan tutte rehearsals in Dallas. A Verdi cast goes home after rehearsal, but a Mozart cast goes to dinner together. Is there some truth in that? CV. Yes, I think so. And even if they don't go out to eat together, they spend the rehearsal breaks together, talking about all kinds of stuff. RP. In what production do you think you were part of a Don Giovanni ensemble that worked best? CV. I loved Zeffirelli's production at the Met, Strehler's at La Scala, and Hall's at Kleinborn. I didn't like Johannes Schaff's production for the ROH. I thought Johannes was a bit of a misogynist. RP. Among your Don Giovanni conductors, who had the most to offer you in terms of sheer insight? CV. Muti. They say the devil's in the detail. Muti is a detail-oriented conductor. To do a recit rehearsal with him is so detailed, so there's no way when you leave the rehearsal that you have any doubt of what he'd like you to do. James Levine was different, but also very wonderful. He was more gutsy, where Muti was hot passion. Gutsy is when everybody screams when somebody makes a goal in sports. Hot passion has an undercurrent of sensuality. Not sexuality, but sensuality. RP. How do you respond to Don Giovanni in the Me Too era? CV. I think the music is too important to reject the piece. Yes, the opera does deal with abuse, but the music also gives some relief. After all, this is the story of an evil man brought to his knees and thrown into hell by people he tried to hurt. I think it's worth doing the piece to show that he's gone and to have that catharsis for all the characters. Elvira is the only one who's still totally messed up. There are so many different opinions about Don Giovanni, but that doesn't stop my enjoyment of it. And now stage door, Emily Pogorelk. Emily Pogorelk owns a marvelously flexible lyric soprano, both warm and luminous. Whatever ingenue she's portraying, from Ilya and Pamina to Juliet, Gretel, and Suor Constance, Pogorelk reveals the character in depth. 12 years ago in Chicago, the Wisconsin native still in her mid-teens took first place in the high school division of classical singers' national competition. Her training included 4 years at the Curtis Institute of Music and 2 at Lyric Opera of Chicago's Ryan Opera Center. Even before arriving at Lyric, she was featured at Glimmer Glass and operas by Handel, Rossini, and Sondheim. Cast at the 11th hour, she starred at Washington National Opera as Cunegonda in Candide, which she learned in only a week. And she won the Most Promising Talent Award as the youngest finalist in the inaugural Kleinborn Opera Cup. Pogorelk's life-changing year was 2020, when she moved to Munich to join the ensemble of the Bayerische Staatsoper. I've learned so much from the wonderful musical staff, who have given me inspiration not only in how we sing, but why we sing. She sang many major roles there, which have led to prestigious debuts elsewhere. In Dresden, she sang a radiant Amina in La Sonnambula. Bel canto is the music that brought me to opera. And at Salzburg, she was an ideally bright-toned shepherd in Tannhäuser. There was also her endearingly impish, vocally and stylistically impeccable Cherubino at Kleinborn. I loved singing Mozart there, and the festival has such a wonderfully supportive public. Having recently turned freelance, Pogorelka is continuing her career's dizzying trajectory this season, with three roles and house debuts. In February, there was Lucia, Hamburg, and Cleopatra is expected in June, St. Louis. But in between comes an especially important milestone, Pogorelka's Met debut as Lisette in La Rondine. My sister Allison is assistant director for that production. I'm so excited that I'll have her in the room to help me develop this character. What a gift! By Roger Pines. And now in reviews, Opera in the USA, Chicago. Genufa returned to the repertoire of Lyric Opera of Chicago on November 12th, after an absence of 23 years. Rather than revive Richard Jones's well-received production from 2000, Lyric opted to import a newer, more problematic staging, also of Covent Garden origins, by the German director Klaus Gut. Janacek's masterpiece of searing dramatic realism and psychological subtlety soared on the strength of the performances by two of today's most formidable dramatic sopranos, Lise Davidson, making a triumphant, if belated, company debut in the title role, and Nina Stemma, a celebrated Genufa earlier in her career, adding Kostelnica to her gallery of definitive operatic portrayals. One could hardly want more finely realized performances than what Davidson and Stemma delivered as the eponymous stepdaughter with a guilty secret, and the fiercely protective stepmother who is driven to commit an unthinkable act of infanticide, each metaphorically imprisoned within the confines of a repressive Moravian village society. Add to their portrayals the idiomatic conducting of Jakub Hrusa, and you had a formula for success untainted, or at least not fatally, by the excesses of Gut's symbolism-ridden interpretation, revived here by Axel Wiedauer. It was never less than fascinating to watch Davidson and Stemma playing off the intensity of each other's performances, their big voices keenly responsive to the music, the emotional specificity of their portrayals illuminating the drama from within, inasmuch as the dramatic conception allowed. Davidson made the troubled heroine very much her own through rock-solid vocalism and her ability to go straight to the beating heart of Genufa's plight. Her forays above the stave rode the orchestral waves with gleaming force, and her Act II prayer, complete with ethereal pianissimos, melted all hearts. Stemma matched her colleague in every department, although you could sometimes feel her dramatic instincts straining against the dehumanizing effect of Gut's bleak conception. Her tonal emission full, vibrant, and penetrating in moments of anxious dread, soft and inviting in quieter passages, she ably exposed the genuine love that Kostelnica felt for the daughter she raised, a maternal affection that belied the stiff-backed sternness as the village sacristan who considers herself one of God's representatives on earth. The admirable tenors, Pavel Chernok and Richard Trey Smager, excelled as, respectively, Laka and Steva, the half-brothers in love with Genufa. The bright, febrile liquidity of Chernok's sound lent cogent dramatic dimension to Laka's progression from jealous hothead to man of honor. It helped that he was the only native Czech in the cast. Smagur negotiated the crags and valleys of Janacek's speech-driven vocal lines with assurance, and he brought hulking self-regard to the caddish, dissolute Steva. Among the secondary figures, Marianne Cornetti did what she could with the director's curious view of grandmother Buria as an imperious workhouse boss, overseeing villagers who went about their regimented routines like automatons in what looked like an industrial autopsy room. Members of the company's Ryan Opera Center Young Artists Ensemble found success in other small roles. Presiding over the original version of Janáček's first mature opera, Rusa propelled the narrative with lyrical sensitivity, dramatic urgency, and an incisive rhythmic attack, comparable in musical authority to what Andrew Davis, a distinguished Janáček proponent of a previous generation, achieved in the course of his 2 decades as the lyric's music director. The prospect of hearing Katia Kabanova, The Makropoulos Case, or From the House of the Dead, which the lyric has yet to produce, under Harusa's baton, is tantalizing. Too bad that Gut couldn't resist throwing in gratuitous and distracting bits of invention that went against the realistic grain of the narrative. Did we really need an unbidden appearance of the ghost of Janufa's unborn son? And what was to be gained by having a half-man, half-raven death figure perch on the chicken-wire cottage that literally caged daughter and stepmother in Act Two? The chilly open spaces of Michael Levine's sets and Cassine Volm's black, white, and gray costumes serve the director's purposes all too well. Almost 50 years after the first performances of La Fille du Régiment at Lyric Opera, the Opéra Comique returned to the repertoire on November 4th in the form of Laurent Pelly's well-traveled production from Covent Garden. Lisette Oropesa endeared herself to the audience in her triumphant company debut as Marie, the abandoned child brought up by a troop of French soldiers, only to rise to the aristocratic milieu of her birth. While her tomboy-turned-reluctant debutante heroine may not efface sentimental memories of Nathalie Dessay's brilliant portrayal at the Royal Opera in 2007, when this production was new, Pelly, in fact, built his show around Dessay, it came very close indeed. The American soprano is an endearing comédienne in her own right, and in truth sang the role better than her Gallic colleague. With a voice more ample than usually associated with the part, Oropesa dealt effortlessly with the most ornate coloratura flourishes and shimmered in Catalina passages. But it was her good-humored characterization, combining bubbly high spirits, unforced charm, and eagerness to throw herself into whatever physical shtick Pelly, or in this case, the revival director Christian Roth, had her execute, that endeared her most to the audience. Lawrence Brownlee gave a similarly winning performance as Tonio, and together the duo made Donizetti's tuneful romantic comedy hard to resist. The part suits the American tenor's vocal athleticism as smartly as the lederhosen worn by Marie's Tyrolese boyfriend. Brownlee and Oropesa played exceedingly well off each other's stylish singing and ebullience. Each artist savored his or her stage-stomping moment. For the soprano, it was Marie's poignant farewell to her beloved regimental fathers. For his part, the tenor brought down the house with the famous sequence of 9 high C's in Ah, mes amis, his bright, focused singing so easy that, with a wink to the crowd, he encored the final portion of the aria. Pelly's staging, framed by Chantal Thomas's picture book set designs, antique maps as Tyrolean mountains, a World War I tank for Tonio's spectacular Deus Ex Machina entrance in the final act, still looked good, although some of the performances went over the top. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Opera News. My name is Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.